it is a Wednesday, midweek, hump day. Bob McCowan and John Shannon with you.
Mm.
Still safe. Still staying socially distant.
Yeah. Partly. How about 17 kilometers? Is that far enough apart?
Bob? Well, partly for medical reasons and partly because socially we don't really get along. So
you still have my Vegas. You still have my Vegas sweatshirt.
It's hanging in the closet. If you get off your keister and come and get it, I'm not delivering it to you.
I'm coming this weekend. I'm coming over.
I've never been to your house. I've never been invited to your house. I don't know where your house is.
No. I'm very
a reflection of the distance in the relationship, above and beyond the distance geographically.
And yet you're moving to my neighborhood.
Well, I haven't made that decision yet.
Well, please let us alert the Peel Regional Police.
Well, I'm more hopeful that you'll move out before I move in. That may be
the case.
That may be the deciding factor in all of this. As we sit here right now, Tom Wilson has a $5,000 fine.
Yep.
Nothing else.
Nope.
And there has been as much of an outcry over this as almost anything this year, and in a long time. In my opinion, everybody has
probably since the last Tom Wilson assault on Brendan Carlo.
What did he get for that?
And he got seven games.
Well, therein lies the issue for me, is that this is not a one-off. This is not a two-off, a three-off, a four-off, or even a five-off. This guy is an habitual offender. Now, he's not out with a gun shooting people. He is not committing armed robberies, but he is doing things within his sport for which he has plenty of talent. And I believe that's a factor in this, because I think it's mitigating a lot of stuff. But
what do you mean by that?
I think if he was a goon in the classic sense, the punishments would have been greater.
So if it was John Scott, or Chris Simon, or any of those guys.
A long list, John, and you know it, and I know it, and everybody else knows it, of guys who made it to the National Hockey League, not on their skill or talent, but on their ability and willingness to fight, because fighting was considered an asset to a team. Teams looked for fighters. They didn't just acknowledge them, accept them. This guy ain't that guy.
By the way, that has not changed in our game.
Well,
that has not changed.
He's not that guy. And I think it's important to point out.
Right.
It doesn't mitigate anything for me.
Right.
But it's important to point out that the guy has got some talent. He could play. If he never dropped his gloves again, he could play in the National Hockey League, right?
Well, not only that. And as an aside, I had a conversation with somebody yesterday, and they said, you know, up until the events at the Garden, Tom Wilson might have been lined to play on Canada's Olympic team. That's how good a player he is.
Well, and I think it's important
to acknowledge that. I don't think he's in the conversation anymore after what happened.
Well, do you believe it's because of his hockey skills, not his dirty play and fisticuffs? Do you believe that influenced the National Hockey League in their decision not to suspend him?
I think it's one of the reasons. I also think there are people within the league that think that what he did truly was not, under the rules, suspendable.
Panarin was on the ice face down.
Yeah. I know. Bob, right? Bob. First of all, with everything that happened, Wilson punched Buznevich in the back of the head. Well, Buznevich was face down on the ice. Right. Yeah. Panarin came in to defend his teammate, jumped on Tom Wilson like a six-year-old on a parent.
Yeah.
Tried to pull him off. And then Tom just Tom pummeled him.
Well, again, you can make the argument that in a game that condones fighting, but punishes dirty hits.
Yeah.
I never understood the logic of that.
No, but just the fact that you acknowledge that, Bob, tells you how the league differentiates. That you've acknowledged it.
I understand but the league condones fighting. If you drop your gloves and throw a punch at a guy, that is considered a part of the game. If you deliver a dirty hit in the course of action without necessarily having a significant amount of time to think about whether you want to do it, that can be a suspendable offense.
Correct.
To me, it's like comparing murder to petty theft.
That's a little harsh.
But it's backwards. It's a backwards philosophy. Above and beyond that, if a multi-time criminal who has been charged with assault or whatever on numerous occasions, I'm trying to think of some nondescript crime that he could commit.
Speeding ticket.
His history will influence the courts and the judges, and if appropriate, a jury, in the kind of punishment. Our system of law not only allows that, it mandates that. And yet the National Hockey League doesn't seem to think that this is an offense worthy of a suspension. Does this make sense to you?
Well, they obviously don't, because they didn't. Yeah.
Why?
No, I understand. I you know what? Because the feeling, as I understand it, the feeling was that what Wilson did was in reaction to what Panarin did. And therefore, there's an altercation, which, as you say, how the altercation is viewed by all of the people within the game is different than that of a dirty hit. Here's the interesting thing, Bob. Two things, because I think that there's something that's going to happen it will get more press than maybe even Wilson, and more money involved with it, Wilson. And the first thing is that what shocked me was that Tom Wilson was allowed to come back into the game. So even at the moment, the referees,
he got 14 minutes of penalties.
Conduct. Yeah. Yeah, he got 14, and he was allowed to come back in the game. There is no way, if you and I were officiating the game, he would have been allowed to come back into the game. Well, there's no way he should have.
Because you're asking for retribution.
No, I'm saying as a referee. No, I'm not. I'm saying as a referee, he should have received a match penalty. He should not have been allowed to come back into the game and have an impact on the game. That might have mitigated a little bit of this controversy over the last few days. The other thing is, now the New York Rangers have come out of lockstep and have criticized the league.
Yes, they have.
Have criticized George Parros, have said that he should not be in the position he had. And really, this, from a league perspective, in my opinion, will be viewed far more egregiously than what Wilson did. You know, they will feel it is a reflection, a poor reflection on a member club criticizing the league office, the authority of the league office. And it will be interesting to see how the league manages that. I would not be surprised. Just my personal opinion. I have not talked to anybody specifically about this. I would not be surprised to see the New York Rangers fined $1 million.
Yeah, I wouldn't be either.
Tom Wilson got.
But I don't agree with it.
Tom Wilson got $5,000, and Jim Dolan, the owner of the Rangers, will be fined $1 million, in my opinion, about this. And what Dolan will tell you is that's the best $1 million he ever spent, because he's trying to protect his own players, and he's trying to tell his fans that we have the best interest of the New York Rangers in mind. So,
he's trying to say the NHL screwed this up. And I agree with him.
As many,
I don't think I've ever agreed with anything Dolan has ever done or said, But I agree with the New York Rangers in this case. And what would be refreshing?
I think he wanted Isaiah hired.
What would be really refreshing is if another team, or every team, even better, issued a statement supporting the New York Rangers.
Actually, that's interesting. In fact, it's funny. Not funny, but it's peculiar. We have seen teams go out of their boundaries and talk about diversity, how important diversity is, and how things like Black Lives Matter is important. Every team in every league has issued a press release, and the New York Rangers will go out of their boundaries and criticize the league office, and will be fascinating to see how they get managed with this one. Usually what the commissioner would tell you is that these are issues that can be discussed to a great extent, but within the walls of the Board of Governors, not publicly. That will be,
that's a pile of poppycock. That's all about business. We're not interested in dollars and cents here. They are.
I think they're interested in profile. I think they're interested in integrity. I think they're interested in public scrutiny. I think they're interested in all of it. But this is one of those ones where I think they made a mistake.
I got no bone to pick with Wilson. I don't know him from Adam, and I'm sure he's a lovely guy. That's what they always say, right? Guy lived next door to me. Who knew he would kill five people? But
Tom Wilson did not kill five people. Come on.
Not yet.
No. Come on.
But
in many ways, Bob, that's part of the problem is that we tend to exaggerate. We tend to put things in perspective. And what we're talking about
wasn't in the context. You took it in that context in your ever-present defense of all things a National Hockey League. I get that.
Listen, I've already said they made a mistake.
Yeah, they made a mistake, and to find the Rangers, which I think they are, I'm positive they are going to do.
Sure, they are.
Would equally be a mistake, and it would be nice for the other teams in the league, who, to take a moment, and just.
You think the Washington Capitals agree with the Rangers?
Sorry,
you think the Washington Capitals agree with the Rangers?
Okay, so 29 of the other 30. I assume the Kraken can't vote yet.
Yeah, they can now. They can vote now as of last Friday.
It would be nice, but it's not going to happen. Look, we got to go.
Okay.
We may continue.
This one's not going to go away, Bob. This one is going to fester for a few more days.
Well, we know our next guest, JP Morosi, while he is noted as a baseball guy, does watch hockey.
Yes, he does.
Does like the game. And just for fun, we'll get his two cents when he joins us after these messages. It's Bob McCown. It's John Shannon with you. And joining us, and I assume you're in that Michigan place, again, in your office, JP Morosi is with us. Look, I'm sure you didn't listen to this, but at the beginning of the program today, we got into a rather heated discussion about your other favorite sport, hockey, and Tom Wilson's actions the other night, which resulted in a grandiose fine of $5,000 and no suspension.
Which is the highest allowed by the collective bargaining agreement that the players support.
Well, then you need a new collective bargaining agreement. And they could have
just got one.
They could have suspended him. Could they not? Could they or could they not have suspended him?
They could have suspended.
Could they or could they not?
Yeah, they could. Yeah, sure they could.
And they didn't. Therefore, it was about as light as you can get. Morosi, I don't know if you've seen the video. I don't know if you have any definitive opinions on this. But Mr. Shannon and I debated for several minutes at the beginning of the program. I want to give you your two cents. Shoot.
Sure. I appreciate it. Here's my thought. I certainly understand and respect the physicality in the game. It's part of hockey and I think should be part of hockey. But there are lines, as we all know, of what is acceptable on the ice and what is not. And when you take the context of a player like Wilson, who has had numerous incidents of this kind, and he gets off this light, I think that this is a scenario that called for harsher discipline than what he got from a standpoint of a suspension. I fully realize, as John pointed out, the fines prescribed by the CBA. But for someone who is in this context, a repeat offender of roughing penalties and roughing majors and misconducts of this kind,
and suspensions.
And suspensions in the past, exactly. I think it's incumbent on the league to really draw a firm line of what is acceptable and what's not. And certainly all of us who love hockey understand that there are frequently discussions about what is acceptable and what should be handled with supplemental discipline and what is that which occurs during the normal course of a hockey game. And I appreciate there are some graying of those lines as to what exactly is appropriate and what's not. But Wilson is a player who has been disciplined many times by the National Hockey League. And I believe this was a circumstance in which a harsher penalty was called for.
Well, John will attest to this. I used the phrase earlier that he is not just a repeat offender. He is an habitual offender. And in a court of law, those things are considered dramatically differently in terms of sentencing. And this is the part of the equation that I think the National Hockey League has missed. And John made a really good point earlier, I must confess.
What?
The referee gave him two minors and a misconduct.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't give him a major for fighting. They didn't throw him out of the game. It was almost as if the officials painted the way for the National Hockey League to mitigate the kind of suspension that they were going to get.
Yeah.
So they wouldn't make their official look bad. Your thoughts?
I'll make this point quickly on the last week or so in the NHL. If you were to look at just from a standpoint of the actions on the ice and the optics of the play, and importantly, the intent and the amount of time the player has to make the decision about his actions, understanding fully the rules of the game and actions that can result in injuries, let's pull back to a 30,000 foot perspective, if you will. Which set of actions do you believe were more egregious? Wilson's or Edler's, which occurred in the normal course of play? I would say Wilson's were more aggressive and potentially, in terms of his actions around the crease in that scenario, more injurious to the players around him. I realize that there was a dangerous play on Hyman. I fully understand that. But that was in the course of a hockey game and a defenseman trying to make a play. I just thought that Wilson's was more egregious, and yet Edler was suspended.
Yeah, Edler got two games. So I don't agree. I don't agree with how the league handled this, but to be the devil's advocate, because I like being the devil's advocate.
No, you like defending the NHL.
No, I don't. I want to talk things out. I want to talk things out fully.
Because
we don't want blinders on and have a myopic opinion and just pretend that there aren't other mitigating circumstances. What do you do when a player jumps Tom Wilson? How does that impact Tom Wilson's reaction? Which is what happened. And I'll tell you what, if I was a New York Ranger and Artemi Panarin came and jumped on top of Wilson for me, he's my friend for life. That's the code. But what does that say when, okay, Panarin jumps Wilson? Now, does that give Wilson license? It becomes really the question.
And it's a fair question, John. And that's where the player safety department of the NHL has an extremely difficult job. And we all know that. That's an understatement. When you look to the future, though, John, for me, I frame it this way. When you consider what you want your game to be, to look like, to protect the players on the ice going forward, what do you want to make in terms of a statement with respect to the actions on the ice? And Wilson continually, to use Bob's word, habitually, makes plays on the ice that endanger players. They endanger the opposition. And when you consider what you want your game to be and to protect the players from serious injury via reckless plays, his actions, in my opinion, require heavier discipline because he has continually shown what I would describe as a lack of respectful regard for the other players on the ice.
And he's shown that. Yeah, there's no question.
In a way that, candidly, Alex Edler over his long career has not. And I think that the context of the players and what they have done on the ice over a long period of time belongs as part of the context in each decision that is made. Because this is in so many ways, and obviously it's a concerning situation with Panarin for many reasons, but it's about the next Panarin. It's about saving the next opponent from a reckless play from Wilson. And if Wilson feels as though he got away without a serious penalty here, he might amp up the aggression on the next player next season, next November, next March.
Yeah, well.
And that to me, I'm concerned about that player and the message that you send with how you handle this particular play.
Yeah, that's interesting to say, because somebody had a long talk with somebody yesterday about this, and we got into it a bit. And he literally said it to me at one point. By the way, he felt Wayne Simmons' response to the Edler hit, because Wayne Simmons jumped Edler, who had never been in a fight in his life when Vancouver was in Toronto last week. He thought the Simmons response to Edler was worse than Wilson. And that the league did not look at Wayne Simmons, or if they did, they did not think that it was suspendable or worth a fine or worth an acknowledgement, because it was in the context of the game. One quick question.
We can go over and over.
I want to ask John, if a Major League Baseball team publicly denounced the commissioner's office, what would be the repercussions? We saw it with the Rangers and the league office last night in the NHL. What would Major League Baseball's answer be to a team publicly rebuking?
Well, John, that's a great question, and it depends on why and the circumstances. If you take an example from this year, recent weeks, MLB's decision to move the All-Star game from Atlanta, the Braves released a statement shortly thereafter criticizing the decision and saying that they disagreed with it. And obviously that's a very nuanced conversation, but that was one recent example in which a team took a position that was directly in opposition to the commissioner's office. And I would expect the commissioner's office expected that. There was no further repercussions that I could tell, obviously, aside from the fact that the All-Star game is not going to be in Atlanta, which is a very significant statement by MLB. I think there are some instances, John, when it comes to discipline, where managers might criticize the discipline that's being handed out. And certainly we're still at a time in baseball where there's a lot of conversation about what is acceptable, what's not, in terms of purpose pitches, hit by pitches, what sorts of conduct should be suspendable and what's not. So I do think, John, there are some cases in which statements are made against the disciplinary action of MLB. And there is a degree of understanding and flexibility in allowing people to speak their minds. I think that, again, everything is contextual, and it depends on probably who it's coming from and what is being said. We've had players take issue with their suspensions in the past. And I do think the commissioner's office in baseball does a fairly good job of allowing people to speak their minds, realizing that's part of the competitive process, and then moving on.
Well, punishment exists to, in theory, maybe not in fact, to serve as a deterrent for future actions. Major League Baseball, in my opinion, got one thing right. When the steroid situation was at its peak, correct me if I'm wrong, Morosi, but they established a policy that if you get caught, you get a 50-game suspension. If you get caught a second time, you get a full year suspension. And if you get caught a third time, you're banned from the game. That's accurate, correct?
What happened was, Bob, they actually initially started with shorter penalties, and then as time went on, they became more and more significant. And so that was a collaboration between MLB and the union to present a united front. They did not want there to be continual use, and they wanted the punishments to be high enough that they deterred the action. So I think Bob and John, to use the same example, if purpose hits, if unfair hits in hockey were met with lengthy suspensions, trust me, the players would adjust, because in baseball, we've seen that happen where in due time, the players have adjusted and we see fewer and fewer suspensions. I go back to 2005 and the number of significant players we saw suspended back then. Of course, Rafael Palmeiro was one of them during those years. Manny Ramirez was not long after him. We have seen players adjust because the penalties have become more and more severe. And importantly, and I think this is maybe where the comparison could be drawn to the National Hockey League, it was the players who have played the game cleanly in baseball who were part of the union and said, listen, we don't want people who are cheating to get off with a light suspension. We want the suspension to be significant, to really hit you in the wallet and cost you half the year. And I wonder if today we heard from five of the top 10 scorers in the National Hockey League or five of the top 10 defensemen, whoever it might be, saying, listen, we want these hits that we saw from Wilson. If in fact that they do, if in fact that's their wish, we want this out of the game. We want those types of actions to be suspended with half of the season, which is what obviously in PEDs we have in baseball. I do think you'd see adjustments, and that's just, that's up to the players. The players ultimately have a significant voice in the way the game is officiated and adjudicated when it comes to punishments like this.
I think you have hit the nail on the head. This is just as much about how the players help police the game legally within their collective bargaining agreement. And for the longest time, the Players Association in the NHL has always said, we don't want more deterrence. We don't want that. That's why the fine. The league would love to fine a player $150,000. They would love to. They have actually gone, they found ways to do it with their suspension, with their game suspensions. But the Players Association for the longest time has protected both players involved in that issue. You know, Wilson's a member of the Players Association, and so is Artemi Panarin, and they tend to try to protect Tom Wilson more than they protect Artemi Panarin.
We can go round and round in circles on this thing and not come to an overall agreement. My point was that baseball has established parameters for suspensions and essentially have, although they've adjusted them, they have not altered from them. They still exist today. And the message is, if you are a repeat offender, you will be punished more severely with each successive time you break the rules. The National Hockey League has never done that and chooses to decide suspensions based on the individual incident more than the history of the player. And that's the problem that I have with all of this. Moving on, I want to address something else in the sport you spend most of your time looking at, and that is baseball. I'll tell you one thing that I have seen this year more than I've seen ever before. And maybe it's just me, Morosi. You know, maybe I've spent too many hours cooped up in this house, in this COVID environment, and I haven't got enough oxygen in my system, in my brain, which other people have suggested is highly probable. Do you think Major League Baseball has told umpires to call a bigger strike zone in order to speed up the game?
That is a very interesting question, Bob. And a couple things are going on. Of course, at the minor league level, we are seeing in some leagues, one in particular, the automated strike zone being put into play.
Yep.
And that could be the future of baseball, and having the strike zone called by the rule book, if you will.
By technology.
By technology via the exact rulebook strike zone technology. Yep. And interestingly, gentlemen, one of the really fascinating parts of this is that they would calculate the strike zone not based on the stance of the player as the player steps to the plate, but rather the listed height of the player on the roster. So if you want to crouch down low and make your strike zone 4 inches tall, if you will, if you have the old Eddie Goodell trick years ago in Bill Veeck, it doesn't matter because your pre-programmed strike zone will be based on your height and not how you present yourself at the plate. Mm-hmm. Such an interesting nuance of baseball, but that's how the sport works. And so your strike zone will be programmed in to a database. And then when you come to the plate, it will be punched up where Jose Altuve's strike zone will be shorter than Giancarlo Stanton's, if you will.
Sure.
And then the automated strike zone will be called accordingly. I would point out to you, Bob, that in preparation for this, there has been a renewal of understanding what the strike zone is as written in the rule book. And from what I have heard from people who are around the game, players, of course, who've played the sport for a long time, they do say that the high strike is being called much more frequently now than it was 20 years ago. And that is one of the reasons why we are seeing such a diminishment in offense in the sport, because a high fastball, especially one with movement, is nearly impossible
to hit.
Square up. When it's at the top of the zone, if it's between your belly button and your letters and it's 98 with tail on it, there's a reason why, if you look at Mike Trout's historic heat map, if you will, the spot that that is hardest for him is up over the plate. That is a very hard pitch to get to. And so why are we seeing the high strikeout totals? Well, it's because pitchers know this. They've adapted to the different zone. And the predominant way of pitching, if you heard years ago, you think about the late, great Roy Halladay, it was all about sinker slider. And eventually he mixed in a cutter. It was sinker slider. That was the predominant method of pitching around 2005, 2006. Well, now it's fastballs up and breaking balls down. There's not as much of a conversation around sinkers, or the cutter is obviously still there, but the old sinker ballers to get the ground balls, that's not the method of pitching now because of the launch angle swing. And so the pitcher, if you think about this, they're throwing the ball above the plane of the sweeping lower high swing. So they're throwing the ball over that plane. And then when they want to throw a breaking ball, they spin one down off of that plane. And that's why
I want to get back to the original question. Because what I am seeing, and I don't know whether we're seeing bad umpiring or whether we're seeing something deliberate from baseball, I am seeing pitches everywhere. Below the strike zone, called the strikes, above the strike zone, inside and outside. We see the little box on the screen. An umpire misses the odd one, but I'm seeing it regularly and consistently. And what I'm seeing specifically is they aren't missing strikes and calling them balls. They're seeing balls and calling them strikes. And that's the question that I have. What's going on?
I think, Bob, that does happen because of human error. I am not sure that it's happening any more frequently now than it ever has. I think the big difference is we have that box on the screen to tell us.
We've seen the box for years. It's a different box now, but I'm telling you, I'm seeing it.
And every umpire has hated that box, and their union has tried to get it vetoed how many times?
Well, we do talk about it. It is an ongoing subject of discussion, to be sure. I do think this. First of all, it's early in the season, and we might see some of those trends normalize as the year goes along. It's also a reality that batting average is the lowest. There was an Associated Press story on this recently. I think it's an important point to make. The batting average in baseball in April was the lowest it had been through 1 month of the season since 1968, the year of the pitcher, the year that prompted a change in the mound itself.
Yep.
So to your point, Bob, hitters are at a disadvantage right now in general. And so anytime that a ball outside the box is called a strike, we're going to notice it more because hitters are already at what appears to be a historic low point in their ability to put the ball in play. We have
but that's, you know this as well. We got to take a break here, but you know that is baseball's fault. That is the people who run baseball, who have empowered hitters, sought out hitters, told hitters, rewarded hitters for hitting home runs, and devalued the singles hitter, devalued the guy with good bat control, devalued, and fans have done this too, devalued batting average. And that's why you've got the situation you've got. Yes or no?
I agree to an extent. Arbitration salaries reward power. But I would also make this point quickly, Bob. Look at recent years and recent champions. The Washington Nationals, the Boston Red Sox in particular, excelled in the realm of two-strike hitting, two-out hitting, and were veteran-laden teams. The Nationals were the oldest team in baseball when they won the World Series in 2019. Names like Howie Kendrick come to mind, Adam Eaton, Ryan Zimmerman. So you're right, while the financial rewards tend to be for the power, the winning at the end often comes from players who make contact. And I hope, because I think that's the best version of the game, I hope more teams, the Royals are one of them, who really champion contact and fluid play and better at-bats, because I think ultimately that wins.
That was a yes, Bob. That was a yes, Bob.
Ultimately, it costs less, and that's why the Kansas City Royals do it. We'll take the break and come back with more. John Paul Morosi is with us back after these. McCallan and Shannon and J.P. Morosi with us on the program today. Shannon, you haven't said much. I kind of hogged the conversation for a little bit.
No, it's okay. We have on our show, we have not addressed at all Robbie Alomar and the removal of Robbie Alomar as someone of note in the Blue Jays and in Major League Baseball.
Is there a debate?
I'd be curious to think I'd be curious what John's reaction is. I don't think there is a debate at all, but I'm just curious to someone outside of the realm in Toronto would think about this. John?
I think baseball handled this the appropriate way, and the Blue Jays did as well. This has been a robust conversation around the game in the last year. Various aspects of social responsibility and just respect for everybody who's part of the baseball family and everybody who is intersecting in any way with people who are in the baseball family, that people who are part of Major League Baseball have a responsibility for fair treatment of everybody and standards of good conduct. And I applaud baseball for being thorough about this. A victim came forward, reported the offense to MLB. MLB appointed an independent investigator to look into it. And the findings were obviously kept in private in terms of the specifics of the offense. Mm-hmm. But I applaud the victim for coming forward. I applaud the way MLB and the Blue Jays handled it. Of course, Robbie has also resigned from his position with the Hall of Fame. This is a very serious matter. And as someone who is involved in baseball every day, I think it was important that baseball handled this in the manner in which it did, because last summer and last year, there was a lot of conversation around what obligations sports leagues have as social institutions. And when someone brings forward a credible allegation against someone in your baseball family, you have to look into it. And it was, by the way, I think it's important to note, MLB looked at it in private. This was not something where it was brought up to the public's attention months ago and then the investigation went on. It was all handled confidentially. And I applaud the way the victim handled everything here, and clearly the victim was not seeking any attention. We don't know the victim's name, and nor should we. But we don't need to know those specifics.
Considering Shoeless Joe Jackson not eligible for the Hall of Fame, Pete Rose not eligible for the Hall of Fame, I would view what Robbie Alomar did was worse than what both Jackson and Rose did. How is Alomar still in the Hall of Fame?
Well, and that is a great question, John. That's something where I believe, as someone who votes for the Hall of Fame, that the Baseball Writers Association of America should take a very serious look at the potential of removing his plaque. For now, it is still there. And Chairman Jane Forbes Clark of the Hall of Fame indicated that the voting on Alomar obviously occurred with the information that we had about his career at that point in time. But circumstances, of course, are different now. And Chairman Clark's statement did not include any sort of reference to reevaluating his place in the Hall of Fame in terms of being honored in the Great Hall. There was no reference made to that. But I'm speaking to you as a member of the baseball writers, and I say for him to be honored by our group, I think we as the baseball writers need to discuss it and need to talk about what we believe to be the fair way to handle this matter. This is a very significant offense, obviously, and a very important piece of information that has come to light after we voted on him, years after we voted on him. And I think it's appropriate for us to at least have a discussion about what our wishes would be. And ultimately, we as the baseball writers provide a service to the Hall of Fame out of our own professional obligation and honor, really, to help them decide who's in the Hall of Fame. And so all we can do is if we came together as a group, and it would be an interesting discussion about what we could even do. But if we had,
well, that's the point.
Let's say we had a vote among our membership currently about current Hall of Fame voters. Do you want to keep him in the Hall or not in light of this new information that put him on the ineligible list? That to me is the crucial part of this. He is now on the ineligible list. And when you're on the ineligible list, you should be ineligible for the Hall of Fame. That's
right. Your point. That's my point.
Right. That's the Pete Rose.
That's Pete Rose.
Pete Rose example. And, yep. And certainly there have been, and I'm sure will be in the future, allegations brought forward of various types against people who are in the Hall of Fame. But the reality is this one, the circumstances as they exist today, this one resulted in an investigation by MLB. This one resulted in MLB putting him on the ineligible list. And that is what makes this allegation and this offense materially different from any other sort of character conversations that may exist around other players who are under consideration for the Hall or already in the Hall.
We have like less than 2 minutes here, so I need a quick response to this. For clarity, the baseball writers are empowered through their vote to decide who gets into the Baseball Hall of Fame. You do not, however, through vote or any other means, have the ability, correct me if I'm wrong, to determine who should not be in the Hall of Fame once they are there. Is that accurate?
As far as I know, Bob, that is accurate. And we vote them in, as you describe. Once they're there, that process obviously is within the Hall of Fame. The plaque exists in a hall within the hall that the Hall of Fame presides over. And so
quickly, JP, because we're really short on time.
Sure.
Do you think that if there was an overwhelming vote on the part of the writers asking the Hall of Fame to remove Robbie Alomar, who was elected by you, how do you think the Baseball Hall of Fame would receive that?
It's a great question. I think they would have to, and they would consider it among their board of directors.
Has anybody been removed? Has anybody ever been removed from the Baseball Hall of Fame?
No, neither to mine.
No.
We must off, and we apologize because there was many places we wanted to go. We never have enough time to chat with you. We enjoy our conversation so much. We hope you do too. And hopefully you'll join us again somewhere down the road. Thank you, JP.
Bob and John, my pleasure. It's always my pleasure, and look forward to the next one as well. Thanks so much.
John Paul Morosi, back after these messages. Never enough time for John Paul Morosi. And we probably took too much
time. He'll be back.
Am I the only one who has noticed the ridiculously bad umpiring that we've seen this year? And I just wonder, it's so bad. I can't help but wonder if baseball has told the umpires, we got to get the time of games down, call more strikes. Is that possible?
I would be shocked about that. You know, I actually think in many ways, comparable to what we talked about with officiating in the National Hockey League, Bob, I think this might be the pushback by the umpires themselves to fight the automation of the game, to fight technology.
Why would you want to be? I think that doesn't make sense, John. They're calling balls strikes.
Because they're trying to tell people that the umpires are still in charge.
Well, but they're not in charge if they're making mistakes deliberately. And I'm not saying
I'm not saying it's right, Bob. You know how powerful the umpires used to be. You know how umpires have tried to maintain that power.
Oh,
and it's the one sport more than any other that the union has always had that leverage.
Yeah. Well, if this is their plan, they're doing it ass backwards. That's all I can tell you.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time. It wouldn't be the first time that a small group tries to push the rope, Bob.
Yeah. Don't pull the rope, push it.
Tomorrow, Haley Wickenheiser tomorrow, Bob. Wickenheiser tomorrow.
Greatest female hockey player ever. Hope you'll join us for that. Until then, for Shannon McCowan. Goodbye, everybody.